tonight on Arena. In his new novel, Scott Turow retires a character who first appeared in his debut, Presumed Innocent, and Marita Conlon McKenna celebrates 30 years of Under the Hawthorn Tree. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The author who pioneered the modern legal thriller, Scott Turow, published his debut novel, Presumed Innocent, in 1987. Sandy Stern, the hero of that novel, returns in Scott's latest novel, which is titled, rather ominously for Sandy, The Last Trial. And Scott Turow joins me now. He's been with you a long time, has Sandy Stern, Scott, and he's been through a lot, or I suppose more correctly, you've put him through quite a bit at this point in time. Is he like an old pal? Or are you getting tired of him now?
No, I don't think I'll ever get tired of Sandy Stern. He's like an old pal or an older brother. As you point out, he's been with me for, if we go back to when he was first created, getting close to 40 years now. But I think this is Sandy's last star turn in the last trial. So I'll have to find somebody else.
I guess though he can retire from being the kind of defense lawyer that he has been throughout his career, but that doesn't mean he has to retire from your fictional world. He can exist elsewhere within it, I presume.
Well, he can. He's 85 in the last trial, which I don't think he's a superhero, so I doubt he'll live forever. I could obviously write a novel set, for example, in the 1970s, and then Sandy Stern could be the protagonist. But as for action that's contemporary, I think it will be hard for him to have a lead role. You know, Sean, characters always surprise you, so I shouldn't foreclose anything. But
Yeah, because I guess it would be very hard. And I will get to the specifics of The Last Trial in a minute. But it would be very hard to kill Sandy off, to just, you know, because he's not well, it has to be said. And in the opening pages of The Last Trial, you'd be very worried for his health.
Yeah. Sandy made his last major appearance in a novel called Innocent in 2010, where he was again defending Rusty Savage. And for reasons I can't recall, maybe because I just thought nobody lives forever, he had advanced metastatic cancer. And afterwards, after the novel was out, various readers wrote and said, oh, please say, don't tell us Sandy Stern isn't dying. So I said, well, you know, he's not dying. But as the years went on, I tried to figure out how he could still be alive. So.
Well, part of the reason that he's still alive, despite the cancer in the last trial, is thanks to his friend, Kirill Pafko, who in fact he finds himself defending in this novel in and around the very drug that is part of the reason that Sandy is still surviving his cancer.
That's right. I sort of backed into this plot when I asked myself, well, how could it be that Stern, who's described in my last novel, Testimony, as a guest at a party, how could it be that this man who's had advanced metastatic disease for a number of years now is out and about and having a good time? There must be some wonder drug involved in his well-being. And that indeed was the germ for the last trial. And the wonder drug is G-Livia, the creation of Kirill Pafko, who is going to be Stern's last client.
And Kirill Pafko, as well as being a pal, a longtime pal of Sandy's, he is quite the man of international success.
Absolutely. A Nobel Prize winner in medicine, given credit for having discovered the RAS protein, which is the on-off switch for about 40% of cancers. So Pafko is hugely respected in the medical world, which is why his downfall is a subject of national and international news in the novel.
Yeah, because in fact he's been defended here by Sandy on the basis that some of the trials, maybe there were some data available at the time people were dying, dying as part of these medical trials, Maybe there was some data that wasn't given out or wasn't exposed that should have been exposed.
Right. The clinical trials for G. livia are supposed to be accelerated or fast-tracked. You have the same procedures in the EU. But one of the problems with fast-tracking is that after a year, which is much shorter than the usual trial period, just as the drug trials are about to close, evidence emerges that a substantial cohort of patients are dying of sudden allergic reactions. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, after a year's use, G. livia, although it helps many people, also kills off a smaller number.
It's interesting. I mean, obviously, this was written well before COVID-19 or the coronavirus was in any of our minds. But it's interesting that perhaps trials of this nature may well be something that we are going to have to think about. You know, particularly accelerated trials are something we're going to have to think of in the coming months and years. Do those kind of accidents, you know, where a book comes out at the time when something seemingly unrelated is suddenly current, does that surprise you as much as it surprises me as a reader?
Well, I had no foreknowledge of this pandemic or any other one. The one thing that I was determined to write about was our healthcare system in the U.S., which is close to 20% of our economy, and the big pharma companies. But, you know, besides, you know, having my finger on that nerve, I had no idea that clinical trials and accelerated trials, as you point out, Sean, would become the issue that they're going to be now. And obviously, if anybody wants to know what the hazards are, they can read the last trial and see what happens when you rush a medication to the market.
I wonder to what extent, because, I mean, your books are highly entertaining. They are legal thrillers, and they're there. They're page turners. That's what you want us to do as a reader, I think, when we're reading them. But do you figure into that, you know, something like Big Pharma? Does it become a target in your mind and you think, I can write about that in an entertaining way, but in the process of entertaining, I can also maybe do some exposition and exposing of things you're worried about?
The short answer is yes. You know, Aristotle said that the function of art is to both enlighten and entertain. And I certainly want to be entertaining. What I'm enlightening about, you know, whether we're talking about clinical trials or just how lawsuits are tried in the U.S. and certainly in the U.K. and Ireland and all of those common law countries. The big driver, frankly, is what I'm curious about. I have to say, I found the pharmaceutical system in the United States far more complicated than I anticipated. It's not a tale of raw greed, which frankly is what my expectation was when I started writing. It's complicated because the government saddles these companies with onerous requirements. They lobby like mad, and so they, to some extent, create their own prisons. And they waste gigantic amounts of money developing medications that never prove out, which is what increases the need for them, you know, to reap enormous profits when something works.
So are you saying that there's a good side to it's not raw greed, it's greed with a kind of tinged with a little bit of tasty sauce that makes it acceptable?
Well, I mean, you just described capitalism, Charles. you know, we don't think greed alone, standing by itself, is necessarily an evil, at least not in the U.S. But, you know, it's the unrestrained greed that we think poorly of.
Sandy, you know, is a real believer in the rule of law. That's a kind of one of his driving forces, you know, at different points along the way, because he is certainly at the end of his career in the last trial, and he's looking back on what he's done. I think there's a sense that he's very proud of how he has upheld the legal system, maybe at times that wasn't for his betterment financially or in terms of popularity or any of those things. Do you have any worries around the rule of law in the current situation in the United States? And would that again be part of the reason for writing The Last Trial and what interests you in The Last Trial?
Well, I mean, as a lawyer, obviously, I've staked my own life on the rule of law. I would be very, very dishonest if I did not admit that there is a lot going on in the United States at the moment that makes me worry for the rule of law and democracy in general. You know, Americans, because they're so cheerfully naive, don't seem to realize that democracy is far more fragile than they think it is. And there have always been anti-democratic forces in our country. I don't want to pretend that this is something new. Mm. I don't think we've had as brazenly an authoritarian government as the one that we have now. And there are certainly a large number of Americans who either support the president or who say, oh, I don't give a damn, you know, as long as my wallet is fat. And that's always been the principal thing on voters' minds. But it's a very, very troubling scenario right now because of the total breakdown of any kind of civility in our political process.
And what do you think that means for artists in the United States? Does it put some kind of responsibility on them? Does it put some kind of responsibility on novels? I know responsibility is a very loaded word, but what do you feel an artist's role is in the midst of a climate like you're describing?
Well, that's obviously a very complex question. You know, Daryl Zanuck reportedly said to one of his writers during the 1930s, if you want to send a message, use Western Union. I don't want my novels to be reduced to political tracts. Mm. And I think the message, frankly, is far more subtle when a man like Stern, who prizes the rule of law, both tells his granddaughter near the end of the book what a great country the U.S. is and how fragile democracy and the rule of law are. And, I'm not interested in writing about politics in my novels. I write plenty about politics on the opinion pages of, American publications. And anybody who, spends 5 minutes on Google knows that I'm a liberal Democrat. But I don't think the role of my novels is to serve as a political platform for me.
One of the other things that Stern says at one point, I think it's about three quarters of the way through, in fact, the justice done in courtrooms is, in Stern's view, only rough and approximate. Now, does writing a book allow you to have a type of justice that's a lot smoother and a lot more defined and well judged?
Well, it would. That's not the hallmark of my work, however. In my books, there's always an argument that the bad guy got away. And The Last Trial is certainly no exception to that rule. And what Stern has to say is something that, has occurred to me in my last 10 years as a lawyer, that, if you accept the various premises of the legal system, there's actually a range of outcomes. And certainly a case like Kirill Pafko's is a great example. Looking at the evidence, Kirill could be acquitted. He could be convicted of some things. He could be found guilty of everything. He could be given probation as a sentence. He could die in prison. And all of those are outcomes that are both consistent with the evidence and the rules of the game. And that's what Stern means. Now, obviously, and I've represented people who are innocent, convicting an innocent person is not an outcome that's acceptable in any legal system. But usually what Stern is saying is cases are more ambiguous than that. And certainly PAFCO's case is a great example of what I'm talking about.
Yeah, one of the problems with PAFCO is he's so urbane, he's so charming that, you know, you kind of get to like him despite myself. Another important aspect, I think, of both PAFCO in this novel, and there are a few other characters, and Sandy himself, the immigrant experience is hugely important. Again, I'm guessing something that it's impossible to write about in contemporary America without bringing that up, is it?
Well, it's certainly impossible to write about Sandy Stern, who, bear in mind, came into being nearly four decades ago without the immigrant experience being part of his life and his consciousness. He is an Argentine immigrant who came to the U.S., actually crossed the border illegally, like so many other persons in the U.S. from south of our border. He lived in a different world where the illegal immigrants in the U.S. at that time were, fewer of them were Argentines. Many more were Irish, Italians, Poles, who'd all overstayed their welcome. He says that as a boy or as a young man, he was taught to keep a $50 bill in his shoe in case he was arrested by the police, so that in the Kindle County, the imaginary place that's much like Chicago, in the event of arrest, there was the $50 should provide a way out so that he wouldn't be deported.
You might finish up by putting my mind to rest on one thing. This is the last trial for Sandy Stern. Now, we've debated that he could reappear as a character elsewhere, and that probably does put my mind at rest. There's no question that this is a summing up, as Sandy does. You're not finding yourself summing up your career at this stage, Scott, and saying, time to put down the pen?
No, I'm already started on a new book, Sean, and frankly, the reception to this book in the U.S. has been outstanding, and, you know, it's up on the bestseller list very high, and I don't think my publishers would want me to stop, so I don't think I shall.
I don't think your publishers would be alone in that. Scott, great joy to speak with you this evening. Thanks for being with us.
Sean, thanks so much for all your time.
That's The Last Trial. Scott Turow talking to us about his latest novel. It is published by Mantle.